We know the behavior of servants, the smiling and casting down of eyes, when one of their number, least and least considered among them, is with apparent favoritism lifted up beyond their ken. They smile, look at each other, and then down, are disconcerted, envious, spiteful, yet on the other hand cautious and apparently acquiescing with enthusiasm in the whim of the ruling powers. These looks, these smiles, Joseph now encountered every day. For the first time, on that morning in the garden when he was sent for to Montcalm, he, the climber of trees, and always after that. For this was the beginning, and his head was now lifted up in manifold ways. He became Potiphar's personal servant. His master gradually put all that he had into the Hebrew's hand, just as we are told. And all that was prepared for, and the germ of it lay in the words of Montcalm and the pact he made, was implicit in it, as is the slow-growing tree in the seed, needing but time for its unfolding and fulfillment. Joseph then received the wreath and the silver apron which formed the livery of the dining-room servants, and which, it need hardly be said, became him to a marvel. For so must they look who might wait upon Petipre and his family at table. But this son of a lovely mother stood out among them, of course, by reason of a superior brilliance, which was not mere charm, rather a union of physical and spiritual parts in which both were enhanced. He was given his place behind Petipre's chair on the dais, or rather at first beside the stone platform opposite along the narrow side of the room, where the wall was covered with flags, and a bronze jug and beaker were set. For when the illustrious family entered for their meal, from the northern or the western hall, they mounted this platform, and water was poured over their hands. It was Joseph's part to pour the water over Potiphar's small white hands, which were ornamented with seal and scarab rings, and to hand him the scented napkin to dry them. While Potiphar did this, Joseph had to hasten with swift foot across the matted floor with its bright embroidered runners to the dais where the chairs were placed, those for the exalted parents from the upper story, as well as for their son and the mistress Mut-em-enet. Behind Potiphar's chair he stood, and served the latter with viands handed him by other silver-clad waiters. He did not run to and fro to fetch or take the platters, but others gave him, and he offered to Pharaoh's friend, who thus received from his hand all that he ate and drank. The dining-room was high and bright, although the light came not from outdoors, but through the adjoining rooms, particularly through the seven doors of the western outer hall and the windows above them, which were of fine, open-worked stone slabs. But the walls were very white and gave back the light. Painted friezes ran round them under the ceiling, which was also white and crossed by many sky-blue beams supported by wooden columns painted blue with round white bases and bright-colored capitals. These sky-blue columns were a delightful decoration and delightfully decorative. Full of gaiety and abundant ornament was everything else as well in this room where Potiphar daily ate his meals. The dining chairs were ebony and ivory, adorned with lions' heads and filled with embroidered down cushions. Along the wall stood lampstands and incense tripods in elegant shapes, standing basins, ointment jars, and broad-handled wine jars in holders, wreathed with flowers. These and all the other appurtenances of the dining-room glittered and gleamed. In the center of the room stood a capacious buffet, piled high like Amun's sacrificial table with food, far more than the exalted family could possibly consume, which was handed to the waiters by servants in attendance. Roast goose, roast duck, joints of beef, loaves of bread and cake, vegetables, and lavish display of melons, cucumbers, and Syrian fruits. Amid the eatables towered a costly centerpiece, a New Year's present from Pharaoh to Petipre, in the shape of a little gold temple standing among exotic trees, with apes clambering in their branches. A hush prevailed in the hall when the family sat at table. The servants' bare soles were inaudible on the matted floors, and the speech of Petipre and his kin was infrequent and soft-voiced from mutual respect. They bent tactfully toward each other, and in the pauses between courses held to each other's noses a lotus flower or some dainty morsel to each other's mouths. Their mutual gentleness was exquisite. It was almost painful. The chairs were placed by twos, with free space between. Petitpré sat with his mother, and the Lady Moot beside old Huilla. When Joseph had first seen his mistress as she swayed past him in her carrying chair, she had worn her own hair, in locks like a poodle's, thick dusted with gold. But often she wore a wig of blue, blonde, or brown hair, coming down far on her shoulders, made into tight little rings, and set with corkscrew curls underneath. Atop was a close-fitting wreath. The wig was shaped rather like the headcloth of a sphinx. It came out in a heart-shaped curve over the white forehead, and a few strands or tufts, with which she sometimes toyed, hung down on either side over the cheeks, making a singular frame to that singular face, in which the eyes were at war with the mouth, they being slow in movement, somber and stern, while the mouth was sinuous as a serpent, the corners of it chiseled very deep. The bare white arms were notable near as far. As they moved among the dishes, modeled and polished as by the hand of one of Ptah's artists, one might well call them divine. Pharaoh's friend took much food into his shapely mouth. After all, he had to nourish a mountain of a man. And many times during the meal, the beaker had to be replenished from the long-necked jug. Probably the wine was cordial to his self-esteem, and made him believe that despite Horemheb, he himself was a real and actual captain of the guard. But the mistress, about whom hovered a slender and decorative female slave in flowing spider-web garb so thin that she was as good as naked, and it was well that Jacob the father could not see her, Mut Emenet, that is, displayed but small appetite, and seemed to sit there because it was the thing to do. She took a single bite, idly, hardly opening her mouth, into the breast of a roast duck, then tossed it into the basin. The exalted parents, waited on by their silly little maids, for they tolerated no adult attendance, only picked and poked at their food. They too seemed to sit there as at a ceremony, for a mouthful or two of bread and vegetables sufficed them, particularly old Huilla, who had to be careful lest his stomach revolt and throw him into a cold sweat. Bess Emheb, the unmarried dwarf, sat sometimes and munched on the step of the dais at the master's feet, though actually he took his meal at a sort of official's table, with Montcaw himself, Dudu, warder of the jewel house, Redbelly, the head gardener, and a few of the scribes. In other words, the upper staff of the house. Joseph, called Osarsif, the Shabarite slave, was soon to join them. At times, the mock vizier, in his crumpled finery, would perform comic dances round the great center buffet. In a corner, there cowered nearly always an old harp player, touching the strings with warped and withered fingers and murmuring rhapsodical, incoherent songs. He was blind, as befits a bard, and could soothsay a little, though but haltingly and unclear. Such was the daily scene. But often, too, the chamberlain was with Pharaoh in the palace of Merimat, across the river, or attending the god in the royal bark up or downstream to inspect quarries and mines, estates and waterworks. On such days, no dinner was served. The blue salon was empty. But when the master was present, and with many manifestations of mutual fine feeling the meal had come to an end, the exalted parents betook themselves to their upper story, and their daughter-in-law, the moon nun, retired to rest in her own apartment in the master's dwelling, separated from her consorts by the great columned northern hall, or went under escort in her lion chair to the women's house. Then Joseph followed Potiphar into one of the adjoining halls, spacious, airy rooms with paintings along three of their walls, and the fourth side open save for supporting columns, either the northern, extending in front of the dining and reception rooms, or the western, which was still better because it looked out on the garden, the trees, and the little summer-house on the mound. The former, however, had the advantage of giving the master an eye upon the court, the storehouses, and the stables. Besides, it was cooler there. In both rooms were many splendid things, regarded by Joseph with the mixture of admiration and contempt which he kept for the manifestations of high civilization in this land whither he had been snatched. They were presents, tokens of Pharaoh's regard for his chamberlain and titular head of his troops, like the exquisite little gold temple in the dining-room. They were hung on the walls or disposed on chests and shelves. statuettes in silver and gold, ivory and ebony, of the royal donor, Neb-Mat-Re-Amenhotpe, a fat, thick-set man, in various costumes, crowns, and headdresses. Bronze sphinxes, likewise representing the god. All sorts of statues of animals, a herd of running elephants carved in ivory, squatting apes, a gazelle with a flower in its mouth. Costly vessels, mirrors, fans, and whips. But above all, there were weapons, in large number and variety. Axes and daggers, scale armor and shields covered with hide, bows and arrows, and bronze, sickle-shaped swords. It was strange that Pharaoh, who, though the successor of warriors, was in his own person no man of battles, but a builder and prince of peace, should have showered such profusion of warlike implements upon a favorite. And that favorite, that Reuben tower of a man, himself not at all constituted to let the blood of rubber-eaters and sand-dwellers. Among the furnishings of the hall were handsome decorated bookcases. Petipre stretched his bulk upon a light daybed, which looked more fragile than ever beneath his weight, while Joseph went up to the shelves to read out the titles to his master. Should he unroll the adventures of the shipwrecked sailor upon the island of the serpent? Or the tale of King Khufu and that jady who could put a head back on after it had been cut off? Or the true and apposite story of the conquest of the city of Joppa by the stratagem of Thutti, the great general of His Majesty Men-Kheper-Re-Thutmose III, who had 500 soldiers carried into the town in sacks and baskets? The fairy tale of the king's son to whom Hathor prophesied that he would come to his death by means of a crocodile, a serpent, or a dog? What would the master prefer? The choice was large. Petipre had a varied library arranged in the cases of the two halls, consisting in part of lively and amusing fables and conceits like The Fight of the Cats and the Geese, in part of stimulating dialectic like the polemic between the scribes Hori and Amenemone, texts and tracts in religion and magic in obscure and artificial language, lists of kings from the times of the gods down to the foreign rule of the shepherd kings, with dates and reigns of each son of the sun, and annals of remarkable historical events, such as important jubilees and extraordinary tax collections. He possessed the Book of Atmen, the book of that which is in the underworld, the book May the Name Flourish, and a learned topography of the beyond. Potiphar knew all his books. When he listened to reading, it was to hear again the well-known, as one listens to music. Such an attitude toward his choice was the more natural because in the great majority of these writings the interest lay very little in the matter or the story, and very much in the charm of style, the choiceness and elegance of the phrasing. Joseph read, with his feet drawn up under him, or standing at a sort of liturgical reading desk. He read capitally, was fluent, exact, unaffected, moderately dramatic, with such natural command of words that the most involved literary style had a happy conversational ease. Literally, he read himself into the heart of his listener, and when we seek to understand his swift rise in the Egyptian's favor, we must by no means leave out of account these reading hours. Moreover, Potiphar often dozed off early in the hour, lulled by the measured, agreeable voice, the level, practiced tone, and often he interrupted with lively interest, corrected Joseph's pronunciation, called attention to the excellence of a rhetorical flourish, criticized what he had heard, or, if the meaning were obscure, discussed it with Joseph, and was much taken with the lad's penetration and expository gift. His personal feeling for certain literary products came out by degrees. For instance, a preference for the dispute with his soul of a man who is tired of life. This, as time went on, he had read to him over and over. In yearning, rhythmical accents, death was compared to many fine and good things. The recovery from sore illness, the scent of myrrh and lotus blossoms, to a seat under shelter of a sail on a windy day, with a cool drink on the shore, away in the rain, the homecoming of a sailor in a ship of war, the return to house and home after long imprisonment, and many other things devoutly wished for. Like all these, said the poet, was death to him. And Potiphar hearkened to the words as they were shaped by Joseph's lips, as one hearkens to music as familiar as loved. Another piece of literature which enchanted him, so that he must hear it over and over from Joseph's mouth, was the sinister and frightful prophecy of encroaching disorder in the two lands, ending in complete anarchy, an awful reversal of the order of things, when the rich should be poor and the poor rich, when the temple should be desolated and the service of the gods utterly neglected. It was unclear why Petitpré liked to hear this account. Perhaps only for the shudder which he might enjoy while reflecting that the rich were still rich and the poor still poor, and that they would remain so if one avoided disorder and sacrifice to the gods. He expressed himself on the poem as little as he did on The Dispute with His Soul, or the so-called Songs of Rejoicing, upon whose honeyed words and lovelorn lamentings he preserved silence. These romances told of the joys and sorrows of a poor little fowler maid who went mad for love of a youth, cooing after him and longing that she might be his wife, and his arm forevermore lie in hers. In honeyed tones he mourned that he came to her not by night, so that she was as one lying in her grave, for in him alone was healing and life. And it was all a mistake, for he too lay in his bed and mocked the doctor's skill with his sickness, which was but love. But then she found him upon his bed, and no longer did they grieve each other's hearts, but made each other the first people in the world, roving hand in hand, hot-cheeked, through the flowery garden of their joy. From time to time Petitpré had these cooings read aloud. His features never moved, only his eyes went slowly to and fro in the room, as he listened with cold attention, and never did he express liking or disliking for the songs. But once, after many days, he did ask Joseph how he liked them, and so for the first time master and servant came again upon the theme and touched lightly once more upon the subject of their talk in the palm garden. "Very good," Potiphar said. "You utter the songs with the very mouth of the fowler and her lad. You prefer them, then, before all the rest?" "I seek, my lord," answered Joseph, "to win your pleasure with my reading, and whatever I read, it is the same."
"That may be, but your effort might in one case, more than another, be supported by the spirit and heart of the reader, for one subject may be nearer to him than another. I will not say that you read this better than other things, but that need not mean that you do not like better to read it."
"To you, my lord," Joseph said, "to you it is a joy to read them all."
"Yes, yes, but I would hear your judgment. You find the songs beautiful?"
Joseph put on a consummately lofty and critical air. "Very nice," said he, and pursed his lips.
"Very pretty, certainly, and every word of it dipped in honey. Yet perhaps a little too simple, just a trace."
"Simple? But the writing itself, which so completely expresses the simplicity, and in so masterly fashion brings out the pattern, just as it always is between human beings, will persist to endless jubilees. Your years call you to judgment whether these words are not the very pattern of the pattern itself."
"It seems to me," said Joseph with great detachment, "that the words of this fowler maid and her bedridden youth do perfectly convey the simplicity of the pattern, and make it convincing."
"Only that?" asked the fan-bearer. "I reckoned on your experience. You are young, and beauty sits upon your countenance. Yet you speak as though, for your part, you had never walked with such a fowler maid in such a garden."
"Youth and beauty," Joseph replied, "may also signify a sterner adornment than that with which that garden crowns the children of men. Your slave, O master, knows an evergreen, which is a symbol of youth and beauty, and yet is an adornment for a sacrifice. He who wears it is reserved, and whom it adorns is set apart."
"You speak of the myrtle?"
"Of the myrtle. I and mine name it the herb Touch Me Not."
"Do you wear that herb?"
"My seed and stock, my lord, we wear it. Our God has dedicated himself to us, and is our blood bridegroom in all jealousy,
for he is solitary and on fire for our loyalty, and we for our part are the bride of his loyalty, consecrate and set apart.
What? All of you?
In principle, all, my lord. But among the heads and friends of God in our race, God chooses out one who shall be especially dedicated to him in the adornment of consecrated youth. To the father it is indicated that he shall bring the son as a whole offering. If he can, so he does. If he cannot, then is it done to him.
I do not like, Potiphar said, tossing on his bed, to hear that something is done to someone that he will not and cannot have. Speak, O Sarsif, of other matters.
I can at once better what I said, responded Joseph, for there is a consideration and mildness which obtain in the whole sacrifice. While it is commanded, it is also forbidden and made a sin, so that the blood of a beast shall intervene for the blood of the son.
What do you mean? Made what?
A sin, my lord. Made a sin.
What is that?
Sin. Just this, my lord. What is demanded and yet forbidden. Ordered but accursed. We, almost alone in the world, know what sin is.
That must be a heavy knowledge, O Sarsif, and to my mind a painful contradiction.
God suffers too for our sin, and we suffer with him. Potiphar asked,
And when the fowler maiden wandered in the garden, was it, as I begin to surmise, a sin in your sense?
It hath a strong smack of it, my lord. Since you ask me, certainly yes. I cannot say that we especially love it, though we ourselves have doubtless also produced such songs. The garden, I will not go so far as to say that to us it is the land of Sheol. It is not an abomination, but a dread, a demonic kingdom, where an accursed command has play, full of the jealousy of God. Two animals lie at the gate. The name of one is Shame, of the other, Guilt. And out of the branches looks a third, and its name is Mocking Laughter.
And now, said Petitpré, I begin to understand why you have called the song simple. Yet I cannot but think that it stands strangely and dangerously with the people to whom the pattern of simplicity is sin and mocking laughter.
It has its history with us, my lord. It has its place in time and events. The pattern comes first, then recurs in many ways. There was a man and friend of God, and his love to his lovely one was strong as his love to God. And this tale of the fathers was of a pattern-like simplicity. But God in jealousy took her from him, and plunged her into death, and she came forth to the father in another form, as a son, in whom he now loved his lovely one. Thus death made out of the beloved a son in whom she lived, and who was a youth but by the power of death. But the love of the father for him was a love changed through that bath of death, love no longer in the form of life, but of death. Thus my lord can see that in the story things went in different ways, and less according to the pattern.
The youthful son, said Petitpré with a smile, was doubtless the same of whom you went so far as to say that his birth was virgin, only because it happened in the sign of the virgin.
Mayhap, my lord, you are in your goodness inclined, Joseph answered, after what I have said, to soften the reproach, or even graciously to withdraw it. Who knows? For as the son is only a youth through death, the mother in the sign of death, and as it is written, At evening a woman, but in the morning a man, cannot we then with some justice, considering everything, speak of a virgin birth? God has chosen my seed, and all of us bear the sacrificial adornment of the bride, but one in particular wears it and is set apart for special zeal.
Let it be as it is, my friend, said the chamberlain, for our talk has led us a long way, and from the simple into the complex. If you will, and greatly desire it, I will soften the reproach, and reduce it almost to nothing at all. But read me something else. Read me the night journey of the sun through the 12 houses of the nether world. I've not heard it for long, though there are in it, to my memory, many fine sentences and choice phrases.